Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Coming up on today's show, Keir Starmer has stepped down as MP, triggering a by-election in his London constituency. We unpack how much of a headache this will be for Andy Burnham. Plus, we speak to an expert about why fewer people are moving house and what this means for the wider property market.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
Summer recess is over and Parliament is back, with Andy Burnham now in Downing Street. In his first common speech as Prime Minister, Burnham set out his vision for Britain, centred on regional power, public investment and economic growth. Here's some of what he had to say in his address on Tuesday.
From the 1980s, this country took a series of wrong turns. Political power was centralised, economic power privatised, the country deindustrialised. Yeah. Austerity followed, hollowing out councils and depriving them of the agency to act to reverse any of this. And then Brexit compounded the damage, ushering in a decade of low growth. Change begins with honesty, Mr. Speaker. I'm not hearing much of it this afternoon.
And on Wednesday, Burnham faced Kemi Badenoch at PMQs, where she challenged him over the cost of government borrowing and how he plans to pay for his ambitious agenda. Ali, what did you make of Burnham's first appearance in the Commons as Prime Minister?
Well, first of all, that clip we just played, I thought, is the most left-wing a Prime Minister's sounded, a Labour Prime Minister has sounded, in comparison to Keir Starmer. I think it was a breath of fresh air for a lot of like Labour Party members and certainly the MPs behind him who are more on the sort of soft left and left of the party. So that was good. The identification of like deindustrialisation, privatisation is consistent with what he said all along. So one of the good things is one of your worries is always it's actually the exact opposite worry that people had with Keir Starmer, that he kind of dilutes his analysis of the world when he gets into number 10. That's clearly not happened, and he intends to govern in the same sort of vision that he pushed for in Makerfield. I also thought he looked more comfortable. I remember, you know, when he first came into Parliament before he was Prime Minister, his maiden speech I thought was just looked a tad nervous, or maybe just didn't look as comfortable, where I thought yesterday he looked extremely comfortable. I thought the speech was really, really good. It's been well received by members of Parliament. So it's all in all, I think, a pretty good start. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I agree. I thought he was good. I thought he was confident. I thought he was really good actually answering questions after his speech. I think he was clear. He had his notes, and that would presumably be one of the reasons why he's probably a little bit less nervous than when he gave that opening address outside Downing Street. Also because he'd just literally been made Prime Minister.
Yeah, yeah.
It was probably the biggest thing he's ever done in his life. But yeah, no, I agree. I thought it was a confident display. And I agree with you, to really name the kind of... To really name Thatcherism as an enemy, but I think is interesting.
Not just Thatcherism. Mm. He said, since the 1980s, this country has taken decades of wrong turns, right, over the last 40 years. That includes Blairism.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, it does.
And so he's not just talking about Conservative governments. He's also talking about Labour ones as well, as part of deindustrialisation and privatisation and other things. So I thought that was pretty stark, right, that he didn't say under Conservative rule. He said over the last 40 years. Is really key as well. It's a real breath of fresh air politically, at least for people like me. The other thing I'll say, just on performance wise, there is a consensus, or there is a view that it takes a little while at the dispatch box for you to get comfortable. It has done for everybody. It took a while for Keir Starmer, even though they did this. You remember that whole forensic thing they kept talking about Keir Starmer, which was really weird. It took Jeremy a long time to get comfortable in the dispatch box. It took Kemi a long time to get comfortable. He looks instantly comfortable. And obviously one of the reasons that is he's not a new politician, right? He just went away for a little while. It was 10 years, but he's used to the chamber. He's been there before. So even though he's kind of being viewed as new and fresh because he's come from the outside, He was like a veteran of Parliament for 20 years or so. So it's all
coming back to him. Interesting to see how Kemi Badenoch responded to Andy Burnham. Obviously, she's reshuffled her front bench as well.
Yeah.
She's got a new list of nobody on her front bench, people no one's ever heard of, as if that's going to change the Conservative Party's fortunes. Was there anything in the cabinet reshuffle that you thought, that's a savvy move?
No, there is something that was interesting, though.
Okay, yeah.
She's promoted Claire Coutinho, mm-hmm. who I can't stand and I think has horrendous political analysis and views. But she's on maternity leave, and she's been promoted, which Harriet Harman talked about on her podcast, which I thought was really, really interesting insofar, and that it wasn't major headlines.
Mm.
I thought that was a pretty good thing because, we know the level of discrimination women face just in general in the workplace, let alone if they're pregnant, need to go on maternity leave, all that kind of stuff. So I think it was quietly nice to see that, that's a woman on maternity leave can get a promotion onto the front bench while she's on maternity leave without it being a big hoo-ha.
Yeah.
Am I overdoing it?
No, I think you're right. I didn't know that. Definitely give her props for that. But
Claire Coutinho is a horrible politician.
Well, also, I'd say Kemi Badenoch favours a kind of slash and burn of red tape and regulation often she talks about the expectations and the regulations placed on business and how it kind of chokes off growth. And
what?
I would maybe cynically say that some of the some of Kemi Badenoch's fans might think actually you should maybe be able to discriminate against pregnant women in the workplace.
Well, it's ironic, isn't it? It's these politicians often their own mentions, their own supporters are some of the most sort of vitriol. Like if you look on Dazia Yusuf's Twitter account, the fella tries so hard to win the love and support of these reform voters.
Yeah.
Never give back. While we're on this, I know we're going to move on to one thing I wanted to touch on quickly, if we may. We've talked a lot about Kemi, and she gets a lot of, like, inside Westminster, she gets a lot of plaudits for, like, turning things around. She looks more like a leader, and the sort of Kemi bounce that never really came. First time in the polls this week, the Tories are ahead of Reform.
I saw, yeah.
Do you think that's significant?
I think it is significant. I think it maybe...
And it talks to the Reform dip that you were talking about a couple of
weeks. Yeah, I think it probably tells you a little bit more about Reform peaking than it does about the Tories. I mean, I really struggle to see how Reform is going to rebuild its momentum here. What can it do? I think it is the end of Reform.
Well, they might need a big win somewhere, like a big by-election win, but I don't see that coming because they struggle in by-elections. I mean, Holborn and St Pancras, which we'll talk about in a second, but they've got no chance there.
No.
That's what I was going to ask you next. Is this the trajectory we're going to go on now? Reform dipping off, those votes moving into Conservative?
I think Reform is inevitably...
How can they recover?
I think Reform is inevitably going to keep splintering, and we've seen quite public acrimony between Zia Yusuf, Tim Montgomery, Nigel Farage over the past few weeks, and of course we've still got this big investigation.
And it just seems like every week is a new scandal. I mean, once we've just heard today about new crypto money potentially that is being investigated. Also, like you said, that standards investigation is going to come back with a verdict. If that verdict is not good, that's another media cycle that they have to go through, potential another by-election. It might be the end.
It may well. Let's move on. Let's talk about Conservative MP Sir James Cleverly. Remember him? He stepped down from the Shadow Cabinet and he's now preparing a bid to be London Mayor. Over the weekend, Cleverly accused Labour of letting London down and took aim at Andy Burnham, accusing him of treating the capital as a cash cow. He says that if he wins this party's nomination, he'll run a classically Conservative campaign and insists that a Tory victory in London could help pave the way for Kemi Badenoch to become Prime Minister. Okay, this is interesting, isn't it? There was lots of speculation that James Cleverly might throw his hat into the ring to be London Mayor. Obviously, Ali, you know quite a lot about London politics, having been very much part of that scene yourself. Do you think he's got a good chance?
When did he become a sir? What's he...
Oh, that's a good question.
I didn't realise that. He's probably the best candidate the Tories have,
For London as well, specifically.
Yeah, I'll be honest, internally within Labour, there's been a lot of discussions. I mean, we don't know if Sadiq's going to re-stand. I think he indicated he will, but, there's been mixed messaging on that. But the conversations within Labour circles has always been, like, whenever you ask people who worries you most from the Tories, it is always James Cleverly. Now, I don't think he will win, and I don't think he has a particularly strong chance of winning, but he is the best candidate they have. And if you look at the last leadership race, people were very surprised that Kemi won that over him, because he was performing the strongest amongst the general public. Whereas Kemi performed better amongst the Conservative base and Conservative PLP. That's a problem because it's a problem for Labour. It's a benefit for him. If he performs better than amongst the general population than Conservatives, that's what you need in London, because London is not a Conservative base, basically. It's somewhere Labour should do well. Traditionally, when Boris won London, they call it the donut theory. So if you win enough votes on the outside of the urban centre of London, into places like Richmond and Hayes and Harlington and those, and Uxbridge and South Ryslip, and those areas, the outsides, then you've got a route to victory. So I think he's a strong candidate.
I think this classically Conservative campaign is going to be really interesting to see what that means in practice. Kemi Badenoch, as we know, over the past few weeks, has come down really heavily on her potential MPs and candidates wanting them to go kind of against net zero, which is really interesting from the Tories, because traditionally, actually, the Conservative Party spearheaded a lot of the net zero policy we see now. David Cameron, Boris Johnson, even Rishi Sunak were all pretty positively net zero. And, you know, that is something that's quite important to Londoners, I think. Obviously, there is, I think, a river to cross on things like ULEZ. And you can imagine how that could be. We saw it in Uxbridge, didn't we? How ULEZ and lower you know, kind of those anti-motorist type policies can actually cause dividing lines. But James Cleverly has basically said he wants to avoid stepping into culture war issues. So do we think that his pitch is going to be more business focused?
Yeah, I think it will probably be more of a sort of one nation conservative, more economically conservative, rather than what's become the modern Conservative Party under Kemi, inspired by Reform, which are culture wars. I mean, if he runs a culture war campaign in London, it's just not going to, it's not going to work.
I just think it's going to be hard for him to adjust his pitch to suit Londoners without it kind of directly going against Kemi Badenoch.
Yeah, he'll have to.
It's going to be really, really interesting.
He can't run like a Zach Goldsmith style campaign, because that worked so poorly. And London is very, very different to the, I mean, London voters are very, very different to the type of voters that Kemi's trying to talk to. So there will definitely be a conflict there.
Yeah. Let's move on. Booking.com has been accused of systemic security failures after a consumer watchdog managed to set up and accept payment for a fake listing for number 10 Downing Street, which, said its researchers, were able to book a bogus stay at the Prime Minister's address and then even left a fake review, claiming they were able to hang out with the resident mouser, Larry the Cat. And in just 20 minutes, 14 people tried to book a stay before Which took the listing down.
How does that happen?
Oh, honestly...
Do you not have to prove, like, residents?
I think this is the point, right? Which said, despite clear signs it was fake, Booking.com did not remove the listing until 2 months after it was uploaded. So clearly there's been...
2 months is a long time.
Yeah. Booking.com spokesperson said a range of checks and verification measures help secure the site, and technology such as AI help us detect and remove the majority of fraudulent listings within 24 hours. I think it is extraordinary that AI could not...
Yes, help detect and
see that this was a bogus... Yeah. A completely bogus listing.
So this person booked and paid for it, presumably. Right? Do you think
Which were able to do it?
They should have showed up to Downing Street and insisted that they sleep on the couch.
I mean, they're calling this a security, a potential security risk. I mean, it's not really. It's not like people could get into.
It's just a
Booking.com failure. Yeah.
How is it a security threat? No one got into any Downing Street system. No one walked into Downing Street.
Yeah.
How is it a security failure?
Yeah, I mean, there have been lots of questions recently about security around the Prime Minister. For example, at the Lead, where I work, we found out that the Prime Minister's home address had been publicly available on the internet for many, many years, and we contacted number 10 to tell them.
Minister.
Yes, the current Prime Minister, Andy. Your good friend Andy, we told him. you might want to take this down. And
where
they
was
did.
It
I can't. I shan't. I won't say.
Yeah, yeah, but it, is it down now?
It's down now.
That is a real security threat.
Yeah.
Because his family still live there.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And you can find it on Google Maps, as I did. You can't anymore. But that is a genuine security.
That's a genuine security.
This is a load of bloody nonsense.
Yes.
From Booking.com. But of course, I mean, the thing I think is more interesting about this is that we're so worried that AI is going to take over the world. And that, to me, is...
Yeah.
You know, that's why we need good old-fashioned moderators.
Yeah, it's more of an embarrassing story for Booking.com, surely, than it is. By the way, Booking.com, have you ever used it?
Yeah.
I've had some horrendous experiences.
Really?
Yeah. It's one of those classic things of, like, offshore... You know when you call in and it's an offshore customer service agent who just couldn't care less?
Yes.
Which seems to be, like, more and more the case. Actually, speaking of AI now... You get a lot of this now when you call and you're speaking to an AI thing. I don't know if you've...
My dentist has started doing it.
What? Using AI to...
Like an AI receptionist.
Oh, an AI receptionist. I hate that.
Yeah, I hate that too. Anyway, we digress. That is it for the Week Unwrapped. Coming up, we're going to talk about Keir Starmer stepping down as an MP, triggering a by-election in his London constituency. We're going to unpack what that means for the Labour Party and, of course, Andy Burnham. Stay tuned.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
As we heard earlier, MPs have gathered in Westminster this week for the reopening of Parliament following summer recess. One backbencher, however, will not be joining them for the year ahead. The former Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has stepped down as a Member of Parliament. The move will trigger a by-election in the London seat of Holborn and St Pancras, which Starmer has represented for the last 11 years. Earlier today, Green Party leader Zach Polanski said he will stand in the by-election, posing a serious threat in the Labour stronghold. Starmer's final U-turn?
Yeah, I've been thinking about how I address this.
Right.
Because you know that old saying, when you don't have when you don't have anything nice to say about someone, don't say anything at all.
Yeah.
I'm going to take some inspiration from that about Keir Starmer.
Mm-hmm.
I will say it is extremely fitting for Keir Starmer to resign now and leave Parliament. Given that in an interview with Henry Zeffman of, I think it was at Sky, he was asked, will you stay until the end of this Parliament at least? And he unequivocally said yes, that he would stay until the end of Parliament and he wouldn't resign early. Given that, I think it's entirely consistent with the kind of leadership that Keir Starmer deployed on the Labour Party, that he now stands down and, I guess final U-turn.
You know... I think it's... I don't blame him for not wanting to stay on. If I had the 2 years that Keir Starmer had in a job, I'd probably want to see the back of it. But there's two things. The first is saying that you're going to stay on and then not doing it, which is entirely fitting with Keir Starmer's track record and legacy as Prime Minister, the number of U-turns. But it's also the fact that even from a kind of selfish legacy perspective, much like Theresa May has sat on the back benches and actually been very present in Parliament, she has, when she was in Parliament, she was constantly kind of... is she still an MP?
No.
So when she was...
But she was up until 2024.
Yeah, even after she was still there in... She was one of the few former prime ministers who actually turned up to debate. She did a lot of work on modern slavery, a lot of work against violence on women and girls. Keir Starmer... could have done that. Mm-hmm. And people would have remembered him as the committed public servant that he always swore he was. The fact that he's now decided, actually, I'm going to throw it in, I can't be arsed, kind of rings true with everything his worst critics said about him.
Yeah, and look, I'll say, I worked a little bit with Keir in behind closed doors. We worked on some stuff early on in his leadership. This is entirely consistent with his... personality, with his style of leadership, with his politics. So there is something to be said about, I think there's something special about the British political system that a prime minister will be ousted from office or will leave office, will resign for whatever reason. They go back to the backbenches and they continue to serve their constituents and they continue, you know what, like we've had prime ministers come back and serve in different cabinet. David Cameron came back as foreign secretary when the country needed it, right? Or when the Tory party really needed it, right? And I'm no fans of David Cameron or Theresa May or even Rishi Sunak, who still is a member of parliament to this day. But there's something very British about that system of going back to the back benches. Look, clearly Keir Starmer doesn't want to do that. And he's now forced to buy election. By the way, the other thing, I was trying not to have too much of a pop at Keir Starmer because I'm over him. Mm. Right. But he announced this on the day of Andy's first address to Parliament, like 2 hours before.
It's very salty.
Yeah, like...
I mean, it's very salty. Also, why could he have not have announced this over summer?
Yeah, because he had to wait until Andy...
Oh, he did.
He had to wait until Andy's first
himself had to wait.
Yeah.
Could he have announced it over summer?
Yeah, of course he could. Yeah.
Okay, well, that is very interesting.
He could have announced his intention. Oh, gosh, you know what he also could have done? When Henry Zethman asked him, are you going to stay? He could have also been honest then, right? Unless he changed.
But then he would have had to resign... No. Then and then.
No, you could have just said no. I don't think you have to resign then and then. Do you?
But I don't think you can say probably not, to be honest, and then have that, you know, have everyone just kind of go, all right, well, just let us know when you're done with being an MP. Yeah. You know, I think once you've, unless you are going to commit, you have to, you know.
You couldn't have said, like, by the end of the summer, I'm going to go by the end of the summer.
But then I think they'd be like, right, so you're resigning your seat.
Yeah.
But then he would just resign. I mean, I see what you mean. Yeah. I just mean, I don't think you can hold the line. I think you have to, like, either do it or not.
Yeah.
So this is obviously stealing Andy Burnham's thunder. But also, is it actually going to cause a problem? I mean, let's talk about what by-elections do. So they cost money.
Yeah.
They use resources, campaigning resources, manpower. They soak up column inches and newspaper space. They detract from Andy Burnham's work of governance. But aside from that, how problematic is this for Burnham in terms of his own governance, in terms of his own schedule? You know, is this going to be a distraction for him?
Look, it'll be a distraction insofar as Andy's trying to pitch for a vision of where his government is going and the vision for the country that he has. We're going to probably face about 6 weeks of circus in Holborn and St Pancras, certainly because Zach Polanski's running. It's Keir Starmer's ex-seat. I guess some folks will try and make it a first test for Burnham.
Yeah.
I don't think it will be that, because I think that's too soon. I think given that it's Keir Starmer's former seat... that it's so early on in Andy's premiership, Zach Polanski running, I think all of those contexts may make it so it doesn't turn into a referendum on Andy's early days.
Also, isn't Andy Burnham's first test winning Makerfield and then just becoming Prime Minister without any leadership contest? Yeah. I mean, they're pretty impressive hurdles to clear.
That being said, this should be a very safe Labour seat.
Mm.
Big Labour majority has always been Labour. This was Frank Dobson's seat, who was the former health secretary, a Labour health secretary. So it will be a Labour test nonetheless, an early test as to whether the sort of Burnham bounce and honeymoon has scuppered the sort of meteoric rise that the Greens have had, though those numbers have pretty much disappeared over the last month or so. I actually think this is more of a test of Zach Polanski than it is Andy Burnham.
I agree with you.
I think this is a major risk he's taken.
I agree with you.
I don't know why he's picked this seat.
I agree with you. I think...
I mean, he's brave, right? I think what's happened... Let me just say this and come in, right?
Yeah.
This is what I think's happened. That they've kind of plateaued in the polls a little bit. Mm. Andy's come in with a big bounce and a honeymoon. Some left-wing commentators are, you know, they're looking at what he said in Parliament that we spoke about earlier, all that kind of stuff, and going, you know, there's something here. And they've moved into green space. The polls aren't great. And I think Zach thinks he needs a big moment, right? So a safe seat is one thing. But if he can take a seat that, you know, shouldn't be green, really, should be Labour, I think that's the moment that he thinks might be able to start a sort of semi-recovery. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think, is it... What happens if they don't win the seat? That's what's interesting.
If Zach doesn't win the seat, I think he's in trouble.
You think he's in trouble?
Well, I think it just confirms that the sort of rise that they had is plateauing, and that Andy entering that space is a real test for them. Because they were hitting, 17, 18, 19% of the polls in some stage. they're now on between 8 to 12. So that's a serious dip. And then the leader of the party being beaten in a by-election. I mean, you should really be picking a seat that you're really confident that you can win if you're the leader of the party. Because that's... I mean, what other candidate are you going to have that is at a higher level than the leader of the party? I don't know. But in some senses, it's also brave. No?
I think it is. I think it is brave. I think it's risky. I think there are probably other... I think Zach is probably thinking he needs to find a route into Parliament and there won't be a lot of chances and this might be the best one. But I think you're right that the Greens are trying to kind of figure out how to be relevant again. This sort of dropped off a little bit. I think also Zach Polanski went a bit quiet because, as we've spoken about on this show before, he had a series of like pretty
tough
media
scrutiny.
Doses of media scrutiny. And now he's probably trying to wrestle the conversation back. But I think it's going to be interesting.
Well, do you think it's over for him if he loses this by-election? I mean, that's a bit overdramatic, I think.
If any party can ride through that, it would be the Greens, because they'll just kind of be like, well, you know, I'm sure they'll increase their vote share. You know, they'll be able to find a way through it. They're not as cutthroat when it comes to these kind of things as other parties are.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see who the Labour candidate will be.
Yes. I mean, there's some names floating around: the leader of Camden Council, the former leader of Haringey Council, are two names that I have heard. I mean, Perai in Haringey led the largest council house building programme in the country. And so I think Labour will go for someone very London.
Yeah.
And I know Zach has said he's always wanted a London seat, I think he's from Manchester, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't know, but I know that he's London Assembly, so... Yeah. Count Binface has indicated he might
that tweet?
Run.
Yeah. That tweet was really funny.
Yeah. Do you think he will? Does it matter?
He runs all the time, doesn't he?
Yeah.
By the way, it costs money to run.
I mean, if he did run, he would go as this time, which was what he was doing before. It was just kind of promotion for this comedy figure, right? So that's why he chooses these big beast by-elections, because they're good publicity. What do you make of Keir Starmer's resignation statement where he said he's going to go work on issues such as international affairs and violence against women and girls?
I mean, on international affairs, they called him Never Hear Keir, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he clearly loved the international stuff way more than he liked the domestic stuff. And I mean, the only thing I'd say is he could have done that from the backbenches. You don't need to leave Parliament to focus on these two things.
I didn't get the impression that these were... I mean, you're right about the international stage. I think he did enjoy that, and I think he was probably quite good at elements of it. Violence against women and girls, I know that as his background as a criminal barrister, director of public prosecutions, obviously he would have actually worked on a lot of that. And I know he said it was a priority for him, but I never actually really believed it was.
No, they didn't come up... Like, he didn't come up with any sort of radical policies that made you think, oh, this is a serious priority for him.
Nothing that was any different from what previous... Yeah.
I mean, do you remember... me and you had this conversation. Like, I think we put it in the manifesto, but it was certainly part of the messaging that under Labour government... the UK would halve violence against women and girls in the country. Like, there'd be a drive to halve. And I always thought that was such a straight halve. Yeah. Why not just say eliminate?
Yeah, you're right. Like, why is half acceptable?
It's always been really, really weird.
Because it's kind of like you're saying, instead of... I don't want to be facetious about this.
I use small boats as an example. Yeah. You'd never say, we're going to halve the number of small boats coming. They always say, stop.
Although it probably would have been more wise to say that, but there's a reason you don't, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do we know when this by-election is? Presumably sometime in October?
Yeah, I think it'll be within 6 weeks. Just lastly on Zach Polanski, there's a couple of things standing in his favour. One, Andrew Feinstein, who came second in that seat, is an independent... and started his own sort of local independent party, won't be standing. Presumably will be rallying behind Zach. That will help Zach, because if Andrew had run, I think it would have split the vote seriously, and I don't think Zach could have run. I don't think Zach would have run if Andrew was going to stand. That will help. I think having Zach on the ballot is obviously stronger than having any other Green on the ballot, and that might boost some momentum around it. But the national polling, where it is, with a Burnham bounce... And given this seat, it still should really be a Labour hold.
Mm.
Obviously, I don't think it is. I don't think it will be a test on Andy, because I just think the context and is too soon, and the context of Keir resigning and stuff like that and being Keir's seat takes some of that off of him. But it's still such a risky move from Zuck, I think.
I agree.
But if it pays off, do you think that could be the start of a recovery?
Potentially, yeah. A bit of momentum. Zuck in Parliament, see more of him.
Yeah.
Be interesting. Okay, was all we have time on this. After the break, we're going to unpack why the UK housing market is slowing down and what can be done to turn it around. Stay tuned.
Fubar Radio. It's Ali Malani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. Fubar Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Malani.
New research suggests that most Britons aren't likely to be moving house anytime soon. Most people are now moving home just once every 21 years, compared with once every 9 years in the late 1980s. There are now around 500,000 fewer house sales every year than there were 20 years ago, even though one in three people say they are seriously considering moving in the past year. So what's keeping us stuck, and what does it mean for the wider housing market? Here to talk us through it is Ben Cooper, Research Manager and Head of the Fabian Housing Centre. Hi, Ben. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. Talk to us about this new research. What does it tell us about the state of the housing market in this country?
Well, I think it shows that many people in Britain still want to move. So our research at the Fabian Housing Centre shows that 18 to 35-year-olds still see home ownership as a significant aspiration. But the reality is that many people aren't moving. Now, depending where you are in your life, that's for different reasons. But if we specifically focus on first-time buyers, that is simply because we've had decades of house prices outpacing wages in terms of their increases, the size of the deposits growing at a time when it is more difficult to save. And when first-time buyers can't get on the property ladder, that means that second-steppers can't move up into perhaps a more suitable home for their family. And it also means that those who want to downsize, perhaps because their kids have fled the home, gone to university or moved to London, they can't now go into a sort of a smaller property. So the reality is we've got this property market that is just almost frozen. And as you say, that means that people are moving now once every 21 years rather than once every 9 years in the 1980s.
Ben, can I ask, you know, when we talk about this housing crisis, I want to compare it to previous generations. How much worse is it now than it was? So for a 25 to 35 year old, how much harder is it buying a house today than it was for their parents and their grandparents?
Well, if we go back to the start of this century, the average house was affordable for the average person on an average wage. So it was basically the average house was four times the average salary, and affordability is typically defined as less than five times the average wage. Now the average property is 7.4 times the average salary. So that is a significant increase. And it's not just certain locations that are unaffordable, it's now actually most of England. So again, if we go back to the 2000s, around about 71% of council areas were affordable to the average person on the average wage in that location. Today it's 8%, so only 8% of council areas are affordable to someone who's earning the average salary in that area. So it's natural that every age group now has a lower percentage of people owning their own home than they did at the start of the century. And that includes, by the way, those who are like 50 and 60 years old. So it's been a sort of slow-moving crisis in terms of the decline in home ownership. Again, mainly because the cost of housing becomes so unaffordable.
Why is it more expensive? Why is it so much harder? Like, what's changed?
Well, one of the most obvious reasons is because we've not been building enough homes. We haven't been building enough homes for a particularly long time, decades, in fact. I think also we have had relative stagnation of wages for well since the global financial crisis. And when you have a combination of house prices going up, but also wages being stagnant, that is really difficult for people to go onto the property ladder. I think also, deposits in terms of the size of the deposit has increased by two-thirds, two-thirds since about a decade ago, at a time when, as we all know, it's increasingly difficult to save. And then the other reason for sort of getting it being more difficult onto the property ladder is obviously mortgage rates have gone up quite substantially. Now, if you speak to, and I don't want to caricature, but someone who bought in the 1980s, you'll typically get the refrain, when interest rates were 16% in my day, they're only 4-5% now. Well, that is true, but when you're borrowing so much more, a 4% interest rate in terms of your monthly outgoings is significantly more than a 16% interest rate was back then. So it's this really complicated picture, and that means that the government, if which it will want to sort of improve home ownership, it had a manifesto commitment to do so. It's in a really tricky bind in terms of this is not a simple solution.
Talk to me about stamp duty, because this is cited as a barrier to buying a home by 23% of first-time buyers and 31% of second steppers and 35% of downsizers. I know anecdotally, for example, talking to my parents, they were thinking about downsizing, and the cost of stamp duty is something that's actually putting them off, because it just feels like they would lose a big chunk of money when they're trying to downsize. Is that something that you see in your research? What do you make of stamp duty? Should we just do away with it?
I think, that is a question for the government. Obviously, there's a significant fiscal implication in terms of doing away stamp duty, which I think is why there does need to be a sort of review of property taxation in its broadest sense, and also including council tax. But it is true that for those who are second steppers and downsizers, that stamp duty is reported as a significant barrier. I think one of the reasons why it's less reported for first-time buyers is because the sort of threshold is more generous in terms of first-time buyers. So I think you have to purchase a property over £500,000 before you start paying stamp duty. And obviously, most people who, when they get onto the property ladder at the start, are not, they may aspire to be buying £500,000 properties. And obviously, in London, they may have to purchase £500,000 properties, but that's obviously less of a barrier. So I think it's one of those things. I wish it was as simple as scrapping stamp duty. If it was as simple as scrapping stamp duty, the government might have already done it. But I think it is one of those things that needs to be part of the picture in terms of sort of freeing up the sort of housing chain so the second steppers and the downsizers can move.
Let's talk about why this is important, because I think for some people, especially some of our listeners who are younger, they might not own a house, flat. They actually might not know if they can or when they can for many, many years. And they might sort of be asking, well, what's this conversation got to do with me? Can you talk to us a bit about the economic impact on everyone from the housing market going through these kind of peaks and troughs?
Yeah, I mean, there is a significant economic benefit in terms of helping people move. So there is modelling to show that if we move transactions closer to a level in the sort of early 2000s, that we could unlock £66 billion of additional economic activity.
Wow.
That's simply through, hiring movers,
Mm.
hiring decorators, and all of those sort of economic transactions that comes as part of that. But I think there's also a broader point. One, home ownership is really important for wealth generation in this country, particularly in an ageing society, when our pension system is increasingly inadequate to guarantee a decent retirement. But it's also really important for people to get out of the private rented sector if they can into more stable home ownership. And the other thing, I think, we've spoken about the fact that people are only moving every 21 years. we can only imagine what sort of economic opportunity they're being missed by the fact that people can't move once they've bought a home as easily as perhaps they could in the 1980s and the 1990s. So there's plenty of really important economic reasons. I think also just briefly, one really important reason that we should be getting first-time buyers onto the property ladder is people want to become homeowners. And I think, you know, it's important we have an economy that actually delivers on people's aspirations in terms of housing and the choices they want to make.
Ben, if I was the Prime Minister, which you can rest easy, I'm not, and you were telling me this is a crisis, we need to fix it, you need to do these three things, what would they be?
I think for first-time buyers, really most the single most important thing to do is help people with their deposits. So as I say, deposits have grown by 66%, the average deposit required, by 66% in a decade. At a time of a cost of living crisis, that's really difficult. And what it means is that people on an income that 2 decades ago they would have been, you know, a number of years into their home ownership journey, they're simply not able to do so. So we need support with that. You know, the previous government implemented Help to Buy. In some cases that was successful, in some cases that wasn't. I think we need to look again at providing similar sort of support. The other thing, we've obviously spoken about stamp duty, is making sure that we have a property taxation system that encourages movement rather than block movement, because it's really important we have those properties available for first-time buyers to buy. And then the other thing that we also need to be looking at is actually, are we using our housing stock in the most efficient way possible? There are a significant number of empty homes and low quality homes, which could become a low cost home ownership option for key workers and for those who perhaps even with a sort of Help to Buy system still won't be able to get onto the property ladder, but they could become doer uppers. And if there's one thing the British people do like, it's a doer upper. So we'll think about whether government should potentially introduce that.
All right, Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting to us. It was really interesting. That was Ben Cooper, Research Manager and Lead at the Fabian Housing Centre. Some in-house news now. This is actually the final episode of Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
How very sad. I thought you were going to cue
cue the tears. I'll be back in a few weeks with a brand new show and it'll look a bit different, but we are very excited about what's to come. But Ali is leaving us.
Yes, very sad.
Devastated. Very, Ali, very sad. What's been your highlight from the last few years?
Obviously, the show with you.
Yeah, our wonderful producers. Mine too.
We do a lot of media, as you do and I do. This has by far been the most enjoyable for me, largely because I get to spend an hour on air with you and it's always fun and exciting. Also, we do have some of the best producers that I've worked with in my time in media, certainly. So that's been a lot of fun. On air, not you, Hugh, everyone else. Monica, obviously. On air, we've had a couple of highlights. There's one, I don't know if you were here for it, but we interviewed a copper and I was talking about police brutality.
And I was here for this. I know where you're going.
And he made a Freudian slip. I don't remember what he said, but he did a Freudian slip where he, in essence, confirmed what I was saying. And then lost his shit later with me on like LinkedIn and with emails and complaints put in, essentially that the interview had been unfair.
Wait, was I there? I don't remember all that.
I don't remember. Yeah, but he went nuts. That was personal highlight.
Because
I didn't even do anything.
Is this the one? This was the guy who was talking about two-tier policing.
No. I think it was an ex-copper talking about racism in the police.
Ah.
And he made a slip. It wasn't me. I didn't even say anything. And then he blamed me. Was personal highlight.
I've
got two more. Can I give two more?
We've got time. We've got plenty of time.
Two more highlights that I really, people should go back. Obviously, the glitter one.
I wasn't there for that.
Yeah, so
go on, tell
the guy who threw the glitter on Keir Starmer, we got the exclusive interview and he apologised and that went all over the place.
He apologised?
Yeah.
He did it and then he apologised.
He apologised on air, yeah.
Like, also, everyone remembers the glitter. Nobody knew what the. What
no
the
one even remembers
meant.
Why he. No. Yeah, what his political.
He said something
was.
Really weird when it happened.
Was it about PR?
Apparently, he said we need like democratic representation for everybody, and then got citizens assembly. He said we need citizens assemblies. I'm sorry.
It was very strange.
It was terrible.
Yeah. But the absolute highlight, which we didn't clip up in the end because it was too embarrassing, was at one point in my script was the word nonce. Mm. And I didn't know if I was allowed to say the word nonce. Mm. So I looked to the producer. I don't think you were here for this. I looked to the producer and I went, am I allowed to say the N-word on air? And then had to scream, no, not that one, not that one.
I meant nonce. I mean, it is so, politics uncensored.
Yeah, and then, so, and then I think like 30 seconds later, I'm just shouting nonce into the microphone being, I meant nonce.
This is, I mean, what I do like about this show is the fact that we've always been able to swear, which I can do on some podcasts, but obviously
on air you can't.
And it always is, I think listeners probably notice, whenever I'm about to swear, I always still whisper it.
Yeah, I do look forward to when I run for public office again. A, like, highlights reel of me saying, like, fuck and nonce on this show.
Yeah.
What's your highlights?
What's my highlights? I loved when we did the crossover show.
Yes, when we did the Halloween special.
We got that guy from Dating Naked.
Yes, yeah. He did change the way I look at the world.
We had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
But it was good to speak to him anyway. Yeah. And he was very excited to be here.
That is actually a call out. Someone should hire me and you to do like a reality commentary show.
Yeah, they should. I'd love that because I actually love reality TV, whereas you don't.
Yeah, so ahead of that show, people might not know. Ahead of that show, you made me watch 3 episodes of
The Real Housewives.
The Real Housewives, one of which the lady took her leg and put it on.
Takes her false leg and slams it on the table.
And I texted you at that moment. What the fuck is?
It's an iconic housewife's moment. Yeah. They're having an argument and she says, kind of out of pocket, like no one's really accusing her of being fake, but you can tell she planned this moment.
Yeah.
The only thing that's fake about me is this, and she like slams her fake leg on the table. Yeah. It's really good.
I mean
I've loved working with you. It's been a real joy. In fact, as you know, when we met I was in a job I really hated, in a staff job as a political reporter, and you brought me on the show, and then I just had reached the end of my tether with this job and I wanted to leave, and almost as if by magic, serendipitously I got a call from the then producer Maddie, who said, don't suppose you want to come and be a co-host on this show? And that to me was like my sign to go freelance.
Oh, awesome.
And I did, and I still am.
Well, you're so good at it and so talented, and I'm gonna keep watching and supporting.
And likewise, hey, this isn't goodbye, Ali.
You just said it was goodbye.
I know, but like it's not goodbye for us.
No,
we're still mates in that. And what about I like when we do a Christmas awards show. That was always fun.
Yeah. And we've done quite a few predictions. You know what we've never done is gone back to see what our predictions, if they were accurate.
Oh no.
Yeah, we should do.
We should have totally done that for this.
Yeah, what?
Maybe we'll do like a special. I don't know what the new format's quite going to look like yet, but maybe we can find a way
of
doing a special.
For sure. I mean, I'll be back for Halloween.
Yeah.
We'll do another Desperate Housewives watch along.
I'd love that. That'd be really good fun. And Ali, tell us what you've got coming up in your, you know,
in the ether.
Where should listeners find you? What are you going to be doing?
So I am launching a new political show. I can't say where yet, but at the end of September. So if you follow me on like Instagram, Twitter, all that kind of stuff. I haven't heeded your advice yet on Twitter, but I eventually will.
Ali, it's been my pleasure working with you. We've had such fun on this show. We've got into all kinds of stuff. We've seen off how many prime ministers?
Two.
Two?
Yeah.
At least two. Yeah. And yeah, it's been a real blast.
Hey, actually, if you look at it, if you sandwich it, we started with Rishi Sunak and we're ending with Andy Burnham. That's progress.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Just a small blip in the middle with Keir Starmer, whatever that was.
Yeah.
I think you and I agree on most things. I would say ultimately I'm probably a bit more right wing than you. Do you think? A bit more authoritarian.
You're a bit more authoritarian. You're not more right wing. You're a bit
don't like pensioners.
It's not the left right scale. It's the up down scale.
But yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's been a privilege.
You've been
great. And I guess that's it from Politics Uncensored forever.
Yeah.
Except for a few weeks, then we'll be back with something new and exciting. And you should keep up to date on all our socials to find out what that is.
In the meantime, you can keep up to date by following @FUBARRADIO on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani Live.
And you can find me at Zoe Greenewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARRADIO.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Well, thank you for listening to us. Thank you to Ali. Thank you to Monica. Thank you to Hugh. Thank you to everybody here at FUBAR. We'll see you in a few weeks.
FUBAR Radio.